At that time, there was no cure for that kind of brain cancer. When I got the news, I shook uncontrollably, and the children wept when I told them. They were too young for a funeral, I decided, along with my family in Vittles, so I went alone. Later, when I tried to bring up their father's death, they didn't want to talk about it. Over the years, we simply did our best to move on, each of us in his or her own way. But Vittles' death still hovers over all of us, and melanoma carries an especially potent meaning for our family. By Sunday, February the 1st, 2015, 3 days after my surgery, I've healed enough to be released from the hospital. Mirek and I head to my sister's house, where I continue recuperating while remaining close to my doctors. Still full of steroids to keep my brain swelling at bay, I feel like a superhero with limitless powers, a wild woman on stimulants, driven, driven, driven. From Boston, I send a series of emails to the administrative, clinical, and scientific directors of NIMH, telling them all the things I want them to know in case I die. The emails make sense, but there are a lot of them, and they're long and very detailed, a sign of my steroid-fueled manic energy. I can't stop the flood of thoughts. I can't stop talking and writing. I write pages and pages about my life. I need to make sure that all that I am and have been doesn't disappear should this disease take me, and the chances are very high it will. Despite my physical fitness, my passion for life, and my deep love for the people around me, I am going to die, and probably soon. I know it, and my family knows it. Training for the Ironman is over. My life, as I've known it, is over. But I am not going down without a fight, and strangely, I'm feeling optimistic. Since my first husband's death from melanoma, I've kept up to date on the latest research about this terrible disease. Every time I read about another medical advance, I think about Vittold and wonder, what if he'd survived long enough to receive this treatment? Would he still be alive today? It is heartbreaking to think that the astonishing advances in this field came too late for him. The newest and most promising front in the battle against cancer is immunotherapy. This cutting-edge treatment uses the body's own defenses to fight the disease, empowering the immune system to recognize and destroy cancer cells that would otherwise evade it. Research organizations, scientific journals, and even newspapers and TV news programs are touting immunotherapy as the most exciting and encouraging advance in cancer treatment in decades, perhaps in all of medical history. My melanoma oncologist, Dr. Hoddy, who treated me in 2012 when they found the melanoma on my neck, is a renowned expert in cancer immunotherapy. Although we're still waiting for the lab results, based on Dr. Dunn's evaluation, Dr. Hoddy has no doubt that I have metastatic melanoma. After I recover from my surgery and undergo radiation therapy, we will discuss additional treatment options. Will immunotherapy be among them? This is my fondest hope, but I also know it's a long shot. At this point, in 2015, there are scant reports on the effectiveness of immunotherapy in treating brain tumors, and the latest drugs haven't been applied yet to metastatic melanoma in the brain. For all I know, people like me are doomed. I could easily despair. But years ago, I learned an important lesson from an unlikely source, Lance Armstrong. In 2007, my father was dying from colorectal cancer, and I flew back and forth from the United States to Poland to take care of him. I did a lot of reading on the very long flights, including, one night, Armstrong's memoir about surviving cancer. It's Not About the Bike, My Journey Back to Life. At the time, my own battles with cancer were still in the future, but I wept as I read Armstrong's book all the same. I identified with his competitive spirit and was deeply impressed with his approach to dealing with his disease, especially when it seemed there was no hope and he was destined to die young. When some doctors gave up on him and he didn't have health insurance or the money to pay for treatment, Armstrong taught himself about his particular type of cancer, testicular cancer that metastasized to his lungs and brain. He then found the best institution and specialists in the United States for treating it. "You must be your own best advocate," Armstrong insisted. "You can't rely solely on your doctors or your family or anyone else. You have to stay on top of your own care, no matter how sick or exhausted you feel. Learn everything you can about your disease and your diagnosis. Locate the very best doctors. Find out exactly what drugs and treatments your doctors are giving you and what they're supposed to do. Never stop researching and asking questions, and check, check, check what the doctors tell you. Get second and third opinions. All of this is up to you because ultimately no one else, not your family members who love you or your doctors who want you to survive, is responsible for your health. You need a support team, of course, but in the end, you run this race on your own." The comparison to a race is no idle metaphor. In high-level athletic competitions, as Armstrong wrote, suffering is part of the process. A high tolerance for pain, both mental and physical, gets you across the finish line. As a marathon runner and triathlete, I understood exactly what he meant when I read his book 8 years earlier. Now, faced with the most daunting challenge of my life, I know that the athletic competitions I love so much are the very best preparation for enduring what lies ahead and perhaps surviving it. I am getting ready for the competition of a lifetime. I have a high tolerance for physical punishment, and I have trained myself to never give up, no matter what. As I face this disease yet again, now in its deadliest form, that attitude, "I will do this, I will make it," becomes my lifeline. Excellent healthcare and unwavering perseverance saved Armstrong's life. I'm hoping it will save mine. The stakes are the highest they can be. Living, that's the ultimate win. And so, although the odds of my survival seem slim, my family and I set out to learn everything we can about metastatic melanoma. Luckily, we are well equipped for this project. Vitek is a neuroscientist. Kasia is a physician. My sister, Maria, is a physicist working in radiation oncology. And Mirek is a brilliant, logical, cool-headed mathematician. Together, we study the mechanisms of metastatic melanoma and the best treatments available. We scour medical journals for the latest studies, and we visit doctor after doctor. I am, of course, terrified at the thought of my own death. But I do not allow myself to get depressed. I don't curl up in a ball or cry. That would drain precious energy that I need if I'm going to have any chance of survival. It's not the first time I've refused to give up easily. Before I began chemotherapy for breast cancer 6 years ago, an acquaintance called to inform me that the mastectomy would be horribly painful and the chemo would leave me so depleted that I wouldn't be able to move. She said that she was sending me a gift that I would need. A few days later, soft polka dot pajamas arrived in the mail, along with a note offering her best wishes and telling me to prepare to spend a lot of time in bed. While I appreciated the gift and the wishes, she couldn't have been more wrong. After my breast was removed, I did stay in bed for 2 or 3 days. By the fourth day, I was up and walking outside, eager to get back to the business of life. I'd resolved to ignore my pain and discomfort as best I could and focus on recovery. I couldn't stand to look at the pajamas, so I gave them away. This episode has become a running joke in our family. When I received my new diagnosis, Mirek and my children asked, "Should we send you polka dot pajamas?" Not a chance, I thought. I have no intention of feeling sorry for myself. Self-pity destroys my composure and sucks up my energy more than anything else. But I also don't realize how bad things are about to get. In mid-March, roughly a month and a half after my neurosurgery, a series of MRIs show new small lesions, areas of abnormal tissue, in several brain regions. They are most likely tumors, although it's hard to tell from the MRI alone. Dr. Iser, my radiation oncologist at the Brigham, believes that stereotactic radiosurgery, SRS, is the best option for the tumors. SRS focuses high doses of radiation onto individual tumors with the goal of withering them into oblivion. Another approach is whole brain radiotherapy, in which the entire brain receives a somewhat lower dose of radiation. But Dr. Iser says whole brain radiotherapy is not the best option for melanoma because high doses of radiation are required to kill these particularly aggressive cancer cells. Anyway, I do not want to consider that sort of scorched-earth approach. Radiation is not a benign procedure, after all. Its purpose is to kill cells, and it doesn't discriminate between cancer and healthy cells. The thought of having my whole brain bathed in neuron-destroying radiation horrifies me. For some patients with advanced brain melanoma and many brain tumors, SRS is not viable. There are just too many sites that would need high-energy radiation. This could lead to dangerous brain tissue damage, which of course worries me very much. Fortunately, at this point, I have few enough tumors that the targeted approach of SRS just might work. And so I am strapped onto a gurney with a custom-made face mask to hold my head in place, and we shoot the few small tumors with precise, high-energy radiation beams in the hope that they will wilt into nothingness. But targeted radiation therapy is not a permanent solution. If new tumors continue to appear, as they clearly are, my brain will soon be riddled with deadly lesions. The doctors will stop the radiation treatment because it will be futile. There is a limit to how much radiation a brain can withstand without permanent damage. The tumors will continue to grow, pressing on my brain and causing swelling in the tight compartment of my skull. Eventually, I will fall into a coma, and finally, when the swelling squeezes the brainstem at the bottom of my skull, cutting off my ability to breathe, I will die. I have to do something dramatic, find something cutting-edge that might save my life. Without some sort of novel, more aggressive treatment, I will be dead in a matter of months. My family and I continue to read every new study that's published in the medical journals. We visit melanoma specialists in Boston, clinicians and researchers, gathering information and analyzing their advice. Secretly, I also hold out hope that my melanoma oncologist, Dr. Hoddy at Dana-Farber, will recommend some sort of phenomenal new immunotherapy treatment. Yet when we next visit Dr. Hoddy, whom I've not seen since shortly after my brain surgery, he is solemn upon hearing that I have additional brain tumors. To my disappointment, he says he's not sure that immunotherapy is right for me at this time. Doctors don't know yet if it's successful in treating advanced melanoma in the brain, he explains. I suspected as much from my own research. At the end of the visit, Dr. Hoddy mentions the opportunity to join a clinical trial in Boston. But I have doubts about whether to go this route, not least because of the difficulty of participating in a trial so far from home. We really don't know what to do next. So we continue our search and visit Dr. Keith Flaherty at Massachusetts General Hospital, a warm and knowledgeable doctor in a bow tie who spends an hour and a half explaining the new treatments for melanoma. Not only is he a specialist in targeted therapy, a promising treatment that targets specific molecules in cancer cells, but he's an expert in treating specific mutations in melanoma. Despite Dr. Flaherty's experience with targeted therapy, he suggests that I try immunotherapy first. He tells us about a clinical trial in immunotherapy for patients with melanoma brain tumors that is just about to open at Georgetown's Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center under the direction of a highly regarded oncologist, Dr. Michael Atkins. The same oncologist my breast cancer doctor recommended when my brain tumors were discovered in January. Dr. Atkins is very good. I've worked with him, Dr. Flaherty tells us. You should be treated there. It will be very convenient since you live in that area, and he's a great doctor. Given my poor prognosis, my family and I agreed that the best approach is to attack the melanoma with every possible weapon. Radiation, immunotherapy, and then, perhaps, targeted therapy. If you get all of those, it'll be like we're throwing the kitchen sink at you, Dr. Flaherty says with an encouraging smile. In late March, about 2 months after neurosurgery and after several sessions of radiotherapy, I finally leave Boston and return home to Virginia. The incision on the back of my head has turned into a long scar, which is clearly visible, since my hair, shaved for surgery, hasn't grown back yet. My new white bike is waiting. Orphaned in a dark corner of the garage, it looks at me reproachfully, as if asking, "Why did you bring me here if you're going to die?" I pat its soft white handlebar, and for the first time since this ordeal began, I cry. "I promise I will ride you," I whisper. A day later, I keep my word. I climb on the bike and start riding slowly through the quiet streets of my neighborhood, steering cautiously so I don't fall and hurt my recently stitched and radiated head. My doctors have told me I have to wait a few weeks after radiation before I can start another treatment. And so, at the end of March, Mirek and I, along with Kasia, my sister Maria, and her husband, Richard, escaped to the big island of Hawaii to forget our dark thoughts of death and to gather strength from one another. Mirek, Kasia, and I bicycle more than 200 miles through the lava mountains. My vision is perfect, my brain working as it always has, and the fact that I'm not experiencing any symptoms gives me some hope that I'm getting better. I'm filled with optimism. I begin running a few miles every day and working out nearly as vigorously as ever. Out in the open ocean, I swim part of the course of the famous Lava Man Waikoloa Triathlon that is soon to take place. On a whim, I even enter a 5K race through lava fields, and I place fourth in my age group. Hawaii affords us a blissful respite from the chaos of the past 2 months. But in the back of my mind, I am endlessly turning over Dr. Flaherty's advice. I'm imagining what the immunotherapy trial at Georgetown might be like, and whether it could actually work if I'm able to enroll in it upon our return home. If not, what then? Will I be able to run, bike, and swim for much longer? Will I ever see this beautiful place again? And what of my family? Will this be the last happy time they remember spending with me? Every night in Hawaii, all five of us stretch out on the tropical lawn in front of our bungalow, hold hands, and stare for hours into the enormous, glittering sky. I don't want to die. I lift my foot to touch a star with my big toe, and then another star, and another, and make wish after wish. Soon five pairs of feet are dancing across the stars, skipping over the vastness from which we came and to which we'll return. We are together now, tight as can be. When we come back from Hawaii at the beginning of April, I call Dr. Atkins at Georgetown Medical School, which is about 20 miles from where we live. 2 days later, Mirek and I meet with him. Dr. Atkins describes the protocol of the upcoming clinical trial, known as CA-209-218, which is taking place in 66 locations and will include several hundred people in the United States and Canada. Every 3 weeks, he explains, a combination of two monoclonal antibody drugs called checkpoint inhibitors will be simultaneously infused into my veins to boost my immune system. These drugs are supposed to teach dysfunctional T cells, which are fooled by cancer into ignoring the disease, how to recognize, attack, and, we hope, kill off the melanoma cells invading the body. The drugs ipilimumab and nivolumab are used for the treatment of advanced melanoma. They were separately approved by the FDA in 2011 and 2014, and in a very short time, they've revolutionized treatment of what was considered to be a terminal illness. Combining the two drugs is more effective than using them individually, but carries a larger risk of serious adverse effects, including severe rashes, thyroid problems, and other autoimmune reactions, he says. This combination has been tried on melanoma that has metastasized to the brain, but only in a few cases and with mixed results. Some of what Dr. Atkins shares with us is familiar by now, but much of it is not. Chemotherapy, which for many years has been the gold standard for cancer treatment, isn't effective against melanoma, one of the most aggressive cancers, he says. What's more, chemotherapy indiscriminately attacks all fast-growing cells, including healthy ones, and it causes many side effects, from hair loss to infections, neuropathies, nausea, vomiting, and fatigue. By contrast, immunotherapy drugs don't directly target cells, but instead treat the patient's immune system so that it can seek out and attack the tumor cells. While there can be serious side effects with immunotherapy too, it holds great promise for treating melanoma. Then the magic words. Dr. Atkins invites me to join the clinical trial. It's tremendous news. Clinical trials have a limited number of patients. I'm going to be a guinea pig, or better yet, an experimental rat, I think to myself with a smile. Just hours earlier, Mirek and I realized that we'd reached a wall with this whole nightmare, that there was nothing more to do but wait. Now, all of a sudden, a gate in the wall has opened and we are ready to run through it without knowing what's awaiting us on the other side. We thank Dr. Atkins and brace ourselves for the unknown. It can work, Dr. Atkins promises. Absolutely, I have seen it work. We cling to his confidence. He seems so certain. I will have 4 treatments, one every 3 weeks, starting on April the 16th, just 2 weeks away. But first, I need to jump through a few more hoops, including a dentist's appointment, to make sure I don't have any pressing dental problems, and a series of blood tests. Most important, I need another brain MRI, to make sure I have no brain tumors besides the ones that have already been radiated. If there are any new brain tumors, I can't join the clinical trial, at least not right away. This trial is not for patients with active, untreated brain tumors, Dr. Atkins tells me. He doesn't explain further, but later in reading the scientific literature, I learned that it's essential that there are no active tumors, meaning ones that haven't yet been radiated. Active brain tumors subjected to immunotherapy can become inflamed, and the patient may suffer serious brain swelling, which can be deadly. At this early phase in the clinical trial, when not much is known about the response of active brain tumors to immunotherapy, it's just too dangerous to try this treatment on anyone with tumors that are still growing. We drive home, elated and hopeful. As we pass the supermarket construction site, I realize I am desperate to see it completed. I cut a silent deal with my brain, begging it to keep any new tumors at bay so I can get the immunotherapy infusions, my best shot at survival, and perhaps my only one. Stay clean. Stay clean, I tell it. It's our only hope. A week later, a few days before the trial is to begin. I lie as still as a corpse for the most important MRI ever. I'm deeply anxious about what it might show, terrified that my last chance for life will be snatched away. The next day, I get a phone call at work. It's the nurse from Dr. Atkins' office. What did the MRI show? Any new tumours? Is everything okay? Yeah, it's okay, she says, her tone less excited than I think it should be. We'll see you on April the 16th. I am ecstatic. I undergo a full-body CT scan, a requirement before starting the trial, and it shows three small tumours in my lung. But we aren't alarmed. Tumours in the rest of the body are to be expected with metastatic melanoma, since melanoma cells travelling in the bloodstream often invade other organs. These lung tumours are less dangerous and easier to treat than brain tumours, and the immunotherapy will likely kill them. Even if they initially swell due to the treatment, they won't cause the same devastation as inflamed tumours in the brain, so their presence does not disqualify me from the clinical trial. Mirek and I are thrilled to get that news. But Lance Armstrong's advice rings loudly. I decide to get a second opinion on the new MRI of my brain. I really like and feel a connection with Dr. Iser, the radiation oncologist in Boston. So I email him, tell him about our recent trip to Hawaii, mention that I'm about to enter the clinical immunotherapy trial, and ask if he'll review the MRI. He writes back to say that he's glad I'm so physically active. I wish more of my patients would do even a tenth of what you routinely do from an activity perspective, he says. He adds that he thinks the combination drug immunotherapy sounds like a great initial plan. He says he's happy to review my MRI and future scans. I FedEx him a CD of the MRI. A couple of days later, on Wednesday, April the 15th, I'm at the hospital very early in the morning for a blood test, my last remaining pre-trial exam. If everything is in order, as I'm sure it will be, I'll be cleared for the first immunotherapy infusion, which is scheduled for tomorrow. At 6:22 a.m., I get an email from Dr. Iser. Hi, Dr. Lipska. Do you have a moment to touch base over the phone today, by chance? I want to check in with you. Best, I'll. This kind of email can't be good. I step outside to call him. The cherry trees are in full blossom. White clouds are rolling by in the blue sky, and it's so early that the sun is throwing long shadows across the lawn. I shiver from the cold and worry. Dr. Lipska, I'm so sorry, he tells me. I see new tumours in your brain. They are very small, but you should get them radiated before immunotherapy. I can't believe what he's saying. No, I can't. I can't wait, I insist. I'm going in for my first infusion tomorrow. There's no time for radiation. They'll kick me out of the trial. Dr. Atkins says I'm fine. He doesn't see anything on the scan. Are you sure? The tumours are very small. They could easily be missed, but they're definitely there, he says. One is in the frontal cortex, where it could be dangerous for your intellect and cognition. As you know so well, Dr. Lipska. You really should get them treated before you start immunotherapy. I can't, I repeat. They will kick me out of the protocol. For half an hour, he tries to convince me to get radiation. He repeats that the tumour in the frontal cortex could be especially problematic. Without radiation, it will almost certainly grow. And if subjected to immunotherapy, it could also become inflamed, causing my brain to swell uncontrollably. It could quickly begin to seriously damage all the highest functions of my mind, my ability to think and remember, to express emotion, to understand language. In short, it could cut off all the things that make me human. If it causes too much swelling, it could even kill me. But, of course, another possibility is that all the tumours will be destroyed by immunotherapy drugs, yes? Don't you think so, Dr. Iser? I ask.
Perhaps, he responds, and he says again how sorry he is. I thank him, and we hang up. I stare at the darkened cell phone. Shit, I'm dead. I'm dead either way. If I tell anyone at Georgetown what Dr. Iser found on the scans, they'll refuse to give me the infusion, which is my only chance at salvation. But I'm dead if I don't tell them, because subjecting these new tumors to immunotherapy could kill me. What do I do? Dr. Atkins' report states I have no new tumors, and his nurse told me the scan was clean. They cleared me for treatment. Did he misread the MRI? Radiology is more an art than a precise science, and it's possible he didn't see them. Dr. Iser did say they are very small. Or maybe Dr. Iser is wrong. Maybe what he saw aren't tumors, but something else. A scar from my radiation, perhaps, or an artifact. I don't know. I can postpone the treatment. I can get the new tumors radiated, as Dr. Iser insists, and then wait 2 weeks after radiation, as the protocol requires, before getting another scan. If that one comes out clean, then perhaps I can start immunotherapy, if there's still room for me in the trial. But if new tumors keep popping up, it will be an endless cycle. I'll get a scan that finds a new tumor, get radiation, get a new scan that finds another new tumor, and on and on and on. I can't keep radiating every single one. I'll have no brain left. Meanwhile, I'll be locked out of the clinical trial. They have very stringent timelines for being included, and no doubt there are many other desperate people eager to take my place. This is my only shot. I'm supposed to start the trial tomorrow. What do I do? The sky is so blue. What a glorious day. No. No question. I'm doing this. It's my only hope. I'm not going to say anything about the new tumors to anyone. I'm not telling Dr. Atkins what Dr. Iser said. And I'm not telling Mirek or Kasia or Vitek or my sister. I'm making this decision for myself, by myself. Nothing is going to stop me from entering this clinical trial. I would rather take my chances than die without trying it. That night at home, I mention nothing to Mirek. When Kasia calls, I calmly tell her I'm looking forward to the next day. I share nothing about my dilemma or the choice I've made. I maintain my strategic silence the next morning when I march into the hospital and head with Mirek into the infusion unit, a large room with individual patient cubicles partitioned by curtains. After I sign in and sit in my cubicle, Dr. Atkins enters with his entourage of smiling nurses and greets me. "Are you ready?" he asks. "It's my last chance to call this off." "So, everything is okay, yes?" I ask. "Yes," he says. "Will you be doing brain scans during this therapy to check for any new tumors?" "No, we won't need them for another 3 months," he says. "This is going to work." I watch him walk away. I feel like a paratrooper jumping off a plane into the dark night, hoping that my parachute will open. I jump. As I sit in a reclining chair, the nurse punctures my arm for an IV that begins to drip the drugs into my bloodstream. I rest my head on the back of the chair and close my eyes. Maybe this will kill me, but I'll definitely die without it. Dr. Atkins believes it will work, and I trust this immunotherapy even more than I trust him. "I will live," I tell myself. "I will live." On the drive home, I tell Mirek my secret. "Dr. Iser found 3 new tumors in my brain yesterday, but I didn't tell Dr. Atkins," I say. "Nothing is keeping me from this trial." Merrick's smile is hesitant, but he nods his approval.
I understand, he says. I call Kasia and tell her too. To my surprise, she, like Merrick, approves of my decision.
Brave mum, she says to me in Polish.
A few days later, Kasia and I have a phone conference with Dr. Eiser. He reiterates that it could be dangerous for me to continue with immunotherapy with 3 new tumours growing in my brain. When I tell him I will not be getting any brain scans for 3 months, he becomes even more worried. But Kasia and I remain united around my decision. We listen, but we really don't want to hear his concerns. I don't know it at the time, but after we hang up, Dr. Eiser goes into my sister's office at the Brigham and tells her he is very worried about me. She hears him out, but she knows I have made up my mind. She keeps the conversation to herself until long after I have completed my treatment. On May the 5th, 3 weeks after my first infusion, I go in for my second. Merrick and I awaken early and drive to the Georgetown Hospital to try and find a precious parking spot in the underground garage of the old cramped complex. We proceed through a maze of corridors to the Lombardy Cancer Center, passing by a portrait of the Pope that the hospital staff use as a landmark for giving directions. Go straight by the Pope to get to the infusion center, they say, or turn right by the Pope if you're here for an MRI. As usual, the waiting room at Lombardy is filled with patients, some bald from chemotherapy, some in wheelchairs, some limping on their canes, but most look healthy and normal. The techs draw my blood and we wait for the lab results. After a couple of hours, we see the doctor, who evaluates the blood tests to decide whether I'm well enough to receive an infusion that day. It feels like waiting to learn if I've won the lottery. As before, I obsess that I will be rejected because of an abnormal blood result or some other lurking danger. But it doesn't happen. Physically strong and optimistic against all odds, I go through the second cycle of immunotherapy without major problems. I am now halfway through the 12 weeks of the clinical trial and feeling good. With each IV drip, I imagine my newly emboldened T cells leading the army of my immune system to attack and defeat every melanoma cell in my body. I will it to happen. I will all of the cancer cells to die. They must die. I'm full of hope and energy. Nearly every day I run or walk a few miles. Nearly every day I go to work and complete my tasks with no problem. With every bone in my body, every neuron in my brain, I believe that I am on the mend. And then, everything breaks down. I never see it coming. 4. Derailed. Sometime after the second infusion, my body turns on me. Modified by the drugs to sense danger everywhere, my immune system has been on high alert since the first infusion. Now, after the second one, it begins to attack not just the tumours in my brain, but healthy tissue throughout my body. This autoimmune reaction causes inflammation in my skin, thyroid glands, and pituitary gland, a tiny structure in the innermost part of the brain that controls the flow of hormones to the body's other glands, including the adrenals. Soon my thyroid stops functioning, forcing me to take replacement thyroid hormones. I also begin taking prednisone to stop the rashes and fill in for the natural steroids that my adrenal glands have stopped producing, and without which I would experience serious fatigue, muscle weakness, and weight loss. My skin bothers me most. From my scalp to my feet, and especially on my back and butt, I'm covered in a red, itchy rash. I have trouble sleeping, and I have to scratch, scratch, scratch. I lather soothing steroid creams all over my body, which help for a while, but soon the itching comes back and I scratch again. The only relief I get is when I stand in the shower with lukewarm water cascading over me.
And there's another side effect that I can't ignore anymore. I really need to take care of my arm, I say to Mirek. Look how swollen it is. It's very uncomfortable.
When my left breast was removed 6 years ago, almost all of the lymph nodes under my left arm were taken out. Without the nodes, lymph fluid can't drain properly, and it builds up in the tissues in my arm, causing it to swell, a condition called lymphedema. My engorged arm has been a nagging reminder that I'm not 100% healthy, so over the past few years I've ignored it and endured the discomfort and puffiness. Now, however, immunotherapy is aggravating the lymphedema, a side effect that I knew was likely. While I see it as a fairly benign consequence of the treatment that may save my life, it really hurts. I can no longer put off getting help. I call the reception desk in the Department of Physical Therapy at nearby Inova Fairfax Hospital and ask for an appointment. There's nothing open until mid-June, weeks from now. I'm surprised and dismayed by the delay, and try to convince myself the time will fly by, so fast I won't notice. But my arm is really sore. I decide to take my mind off it by making a quick trip to see my daughter and her family in New Haven. It's been a month since we were together, and I yearn to see them, to spend as much time with them as I can while I still have the time to spend. My third infusion is scheduled for May the 26th, a week away. I'll be on a northbound train the very next day. May the 27th dawns hot and humid, a taste of the brutal summer that will soon stifle the mid-Atlantic. My left arm is swollen and aching, and my full body rash is driving me crazy. But my physical discomfort is dwarfed by the joy I feel at the thought of seeing my daughter, son-in-law, and grandsons. Not for a moment do I consider cancelling my trip. At noon, Mirek drops me off at Union Station in downtown Washington, D.C., and I board the Amtrak to New Haven. I clamber onto the train with my few belongings in a small suitcase and head for the quiet car, while cell phones and loud conversations are banned. I find a window seat in a row with no other passengers, nestle into the cushions, pull a book from my purse, and cherish the solitude. The train rumbles slowly across Maryland, then New Jersey. Then, in the middle of nowhere, it grinds to a halt. Through the window, I see empty fields, green and expansive pastures, and a few trees dotting the landscape. There's no station in the vicinity, not so much as a house. After a moment, the lights in the train and the air conditioning system go out. All of the electricity has been shut off. We wait in total silence, a quiet that I appreciated a short time earlier, but not anymore. This silence is irritating. It lacks purpose. I place my bloated arm on the narrow windowsill. It's too high and makes my arm even more uncomfortable. But the armrest doesn't work either. It's too low. My arm is painful, my hand swollen. I stare at its fingers and palm, so fat and tender that they look like they could burst. Why didn't I call the therapist sooner? I try to focus on my book, try to be patient and relax. To no avail. My discomfort persists and the delay grows. Minutes tick by and we're still not moving. There are no announcements, and no one in the train car seems to know what's going on. Finally, after at least half an hour, the loudspeaker crackles. "There's a problem on the tracks. A tree fell," a voice announces. "We're waiting for a maintenance crew to arrive and remove it. Then we'll be on our way." More time goes by, and still nothing happens. The car is hot, and I'm thirsty. My skin feels like it's on fire. In addition to the pulsating pain in my arm, I realize that I also have a headache, a mild but nagging throb that fills my whole skull. 2 hours pass before we begin to move. But even then, we dawdle along at a pace that seems even slower than before.
It's nearly as excruciating as if we weren't moving at all. I storm out of the quiet car into the vestibule and call Kasia, fuming. Unbelievable! This Amtrak is good for nothing! I hiss in Polish. How can they keep people waiting, uninformed, left to fend for themselves with no food or water? Complete lack of responsibility! Kasia listens patiently and tells me she can't wait to see me. Her voice, so dear, does nothing to calm me. It takes 7 hours to get to New Haven instead of the usual 5. When the train pulls into the station, I loudly share my unhappiness with everyone around. Even 5 hours would be too long, I say, daring anyone to challenge me. The infrastructure in our country is pitiful. In Europe, this trip would take a fraction of the time. I'm tired and hot, and this headache won't go away. I hail a cab at the station. In 15 minutes, it pulls up to Kasia and Jake's home. When I walk in the front door, Lucien and Sebastian leap at me with such force that I almost end up on the floor. Babcia! Babcia! They scream in unison. I love you! I love you so much! I missed you! I kiss their ketchup-stained faces and hug them and don't want to let go. Kasia runs out of the kitchen to greet me. Mama! She exclaims. I'm so happy you're here! She kisses me and I press my body against hers with all my might. I want to feel the warmth of my daughter, to let her know that I've missed her and I'm very happy to be with her. From a beautiful little girl, she's turned into a gorgeous, mature woman, smart and exceptionally devoted to her family and her challenging work. I want to tell her, as I have so many times before, how proud I am, how pleased to see her so pretty and so accomplished. But that's not what I say. Amtrak sucks. Those are the first words from my mouth. She looks a little shocked. I can't tell you how long that train ride was, I say forcefully. I will never take that train again. Mum, come in and sit down. Let's relax and it's irresponsible to keep people on the train for so long. It was horrible. I see her staring at me, imploring me to let it go, but I have no intention of doing that. I've been wronged and I want her sympathy. There is no excuse, I continue. It's a shame that in this rich and technologically advanced country, the trains are in such poor shape. In Europe, they run so much faster. Can you believe how long I was on the train? Sebastian and Lucien tug at my hand, trying to pull me into a game. But I want the boys to understand what I've just been through too. It was a terrible experience. Amtrak sucks, I say it again and again. Lucien and Sebastian are getting bored with my tirade, and soon they disappear into their room to continue their wild games, screaming and laughing. Okay, Mum, enough about the train, Kasia breaks in. You're here now. What can I get you? Do you want to lie down? Enough, I think. I am deeply aggrieved. The train was horrible. Let's talk about something else, she says gently. Why, can't I express my opinion? I shoot back bitterly. Kasia tries to brush off my outburst. She tends to the boys and starts preparing our dinner. But I can't move on. I'm irritated by Kasia. I'm irritated by the boys, by everything. Suddenly I am so, so tired. And this headache, it's not going away. I stay in New Haven for 2 days as planned. But my time there is not nearly as restorative as it was intended to be, either for me or for my family. I can't stop talking about my train ride. I bring it up with Kasia and Jake, and with their friends too, when they drop by to say hello and wish me well. They listen politely, but I can see from their expressions that they're thinking, "Why are you telling this story? Why is it such a big deal?" But it is a big deal. It's a huge deal. If they can't see that, there must be something wrong with them. Amtrak sucks. The refrain circles around in my mind like a toy train looping a closed track. Amtrak sucks. I say it out loud, too, over and over, to anyone who will listen. It's not only Amtrak that is the object of my ire. I'm irritated if our lunch is even 5 minutes later than Kasia promised. I can't stand how loud the boys are. I find everything my family does annoying, and I tell them so. On the second afternoon of my visit, Sebastian comes running over, laughing loudly, and bumps into me. It pisses me off. Be quiet, I tell him. Just stop it, stop it. He looks like he's about to cry. You're so mean, he says. Oh, come on, you can't be that sensitive. Can't you take criticism? That's just crazy. He bursts into tears and runs from the room. Kasia comes in from the kitchen. Really, Mom, she says. You're being mean. It's not like you. I cannot believe what I'm hearing. She's siding with him. I'm mean. Is she serious? I turn away. I don't want to talk to any of them. I go into the guest room and close the door. Why is Kasia arguing with me? I wonder as I lie in the darkened bedroom nursing my swollen arm. I deserve better treatment than this. I'm not the only one who's baffled by how this visit is going. I will learn much later that, as I'm sequestered upstairs on this late spring day, Jake and Kasia downstairs in the kitchen are talking about me, quietly so I can't hear them. They're both surprised by the way I snapped at Sebastian, to whom I'm always so loving. While I never fail to speak my mind, I'm also reflexively warm and affectionate toward my family. They now find me distant and anxious, and my obsession with the train puzzles them. They can't figure out what's going on. Kasia thinks it must be the anxiety of the experimental treatment and the horror of facing my own mortality. Maybe I'm depressed, she speculates. But Jake isn't so sure. I've had brushes with death before, he notes, but I was always open and vulnerable and shared with them my fears and emotions. This feels off, they agree. It may be obvious to them that I'm acting strangely, but I can't see that my behaviour is unusual. Nor can I see the confusion and suffering it is causing. Upstairs in the guest room, I'm in my own world, fixated on their poor treatment of me and the gross incompetence of the American railway system. What's wrong with all of them? Kasia is not being as warm as she usually is. The boys are too noisy. They're getting spoiled. Amtrak sucks. My headache is back. This damned heat. Compared to the itching and other side effects of immunotherapy, the pain in my head feels like a minor inconvenience. Still, I called the nurse at Georgetown yesterday, just to be sure. But when I described it as mild and intermittent, we decided it wasn't a big worry, although she asked me to keep an eye on it. It's certainly not the kind of severe or sudden headache that would set off alarm bells for me, Kasia, or my doctors. I've soldiered through much worse, I think. And I failed to see it as a warning sign. I don't realize it, and no one around me does either. But deep inside my brain, a full-scale war has erupted. The tumors that were radiated are shedding dead cells and creating waste and necrotic, or dead, tissue. These old tumors are also under attack by immunotherapy, as are the three new tumors that Dr. Azer found shortly before I was to enter the clinical trial. Mortally wounded by my modified T-cells, the cancer cells from the six tumors found between January and April are like tiny dead bodies. They must be broken up into smaller particles and removed from my brain through the blood and lymphatic systems. Throughout my brain, the tissues are inflamed and swollen from the metastases and the double assault of radiation and immunotherapy. What's more, my blood-brain barrier, which normally prevents circulating toxins and other substances from entering the brain, has become disrupted by immunotherapy and is leaking fluids through small vessels and capillaries. The fluids are pooling in my brain, irritating the brain tissue and causing it to swell, a condition called vasogenic edema. All of this is wreaking havoc on my brain. just as my behaviour is wreaking havoc on my family. Although I knew I could pay a heavy price for the chance to live, I had no idea how high the cost would be. My brain, in particular my frontal lobe, which Dr. Iser was especially worried about because it controls higher cognitive functions, is a deadly battlefield. And my life is in serious jeopardy. Composed of hard bones, the skull is not flexible. It can't expand outward to release pressure in the brain. When the brain swells, there's only one place it can go. The foramen magnum, the hole in the base of the skull through which the brainstem exits into the spinal cord. The most primitive part of the brain, the brainstem controls primal functions, including respiration, heart rate, and blood pressure. If the brainstem is squeezed by swelling or is otherwise injured, a person can go into cardiopulmonary arrest, the heart and breathing stop, and die. If I could have recognized that my frontal lobe was under attack and the effect it was having on my personality, I would perhaps have seen some parallels with the famous case of Phineas Gage, a railroad worker who suffered a horrific injury in the mid-19th century. Gage's personal tragedy marked a turning point in the study of the brain. He'd been using a long iron rod to pound blasting powder into a mass of rock when the explosive suddenly went off, sending the rod shooting through his head like a javelin. It entered his left cheek and passed through the left side of his brain, obliterating much of his frontal lobe, then exited through the top of his skull and landed some 80 feet from where Gage stood. Incredibly, the 25-year-old survived, living for another 11 years with a huge hole in his head and with dramatic changes in his personality. Once a likable guy, he began to swear constantly, couldn't follow through on basic tasks, and seemed to care about no one but himself. His behaviour grew so bad that he was fired, after which he lived a peripatetic existence, ultimately perishing after a series of convulsions that may or may not have been connected to his devastating injury. Gage's misfortune taught us something critical about the connection between the frontal lobe and the mind, although not the lesson that was assumed at the time. Contemporary scientists theorized that the portions of Gage's brain that were destroyed in the accident were responsible for controlling his personality. But now we know the truth is more complicated. Emotions, which form the foundations of our personalities, are not contained in a single brain region, as once believed, but rather are distributed throughout the brain in a complex network that we don't yet fully understand. It is clear, nevertheless, that the frontal lobe is intricately connected to the ways in which personality is expressed. People with damage to their frontal lobes, whether as a result of head trauma, like Gage, cancer, like me, or a neurodegenerative disease, as with Alzheimer's patients, often undergo significant personality changes. In some cases, these changes are truly bizarre, combining noticeable disinhibition with little appreciation or concern about the consequences of one's actions. More extreme examples may include loud and frequent swearing or sexually inappropriate behaviours. Most mental conditions, from Alzheimer's to schizophrenia, from bipolar disorder to depression, involve some sort of change to a person's emotions, and thus his or her personality. But whenever someone exhibits significant personality changes, especially over a relatively short period, it's also possible that a frontal lobe problem, a tumour or injury, for example, is to blame. Like my headaches, the changes in my personality signal that something serious is going on. Squashed like jello in a jar and pushed out of place from the swelling, my frontal cortex can't perform its supervisory function of telling me to stop and think before I jump into action. In a sense, this crucial part of my brain has reverted to an earlier state, not unlike the brain of a small child who hasn't yet learned how to exercise self-control or navigate delicate